Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet M.L. Liebler. M.L. Liebler is an internationally known and widely published Detroit poet, university professor, literary arts activist, and arts organizer. And he is the author of 13 books, including Wide Awake in Someone Else's Dream, published by Wayne State University Press. Wide Awake won both the Patterson Poetry Prize for Literary Excellence and the American Indie Book Award for 2009. Liebler has taught at Wayne State University in Detroit since 1980, and he is the founding director of both the National Writer's Voice Project in Detroit and the Spring-Fed Arts Metro Detroit Writers Literary Arts Organization. In 2010, he received the Barnes & Noble Poets and Writers Writers for Writers Award with Maxine Hong Kingston and Juno Diaz. He's the editor of a new anthology of working-class poetry entitled Working Words, Punching the Clock and Kicking Out the Jams, with a foreword by Ben Hamper. Hi, ML. How are you doing?
It's great to be here.
It's great to have you back.
Thank you.
From Thanks Detroit. And that's a long bio, but we had to cut it down because, you know—
Thank God I'm bored.
You've done a lot of things.
Listeners are already frying eggs now or something.
Okay. So you have this great anthology. So go ahead and talk about it.
Well, it's called Working Words, Punching the Clock and Kicking Out the Jams from Coffeehouse Press. It's a collection of poems, stories, and creative nonfiction, memoir, and history all jammed into this kind of 560-page book. And there's a number of different writers in it being represented, everybody from Amiri Baraka to Bob Dylan to Dorothy Day, Walt Whitman is in, and Eminem, and there's a number of kind of popular music people as well, hence the subtitle Kicking Out the Jams. And I noticed on eBay it's being sold as get this book. It has Bob Dylan, Eminem, Jack White, you know,
and some poets too.
And some poets, yeah. It doesn't even mention that. So it's like get this desk copy or whatever you call those, the bound galleys. But at any rate, I just wanted to sort of pay homage and to capture in print a variety of different writers, most of them known, some unknown or up and coming. And give people a taste overall of not just work, but of working class life.
Okay.
The morals, the ethics, the home life, the public life, all those kinds of things.
Okay. Well, listeners can't see it. It's a really cool cover with these cool work boots on it. So you have to buy it.
That's very cool.
But could we hear some poems, do you think?
Well, yeah. You know, there's a number of poems. Sometimes people have characterized it as mostly poetry, but when they actually look at it, it's really about 50-50. I didn't know that until somebody on the radio in Berkeley, California, looked at it. And I said, no. You know, he said, oh, it's all poets. And then I looked and I said, no, look, right here, it's half and half. So it is really. There's a number of different poets. I have, you know, all of them are my favorites, of course. But there's a variety of them that I really enjoyed, and that's why I asked the authors to kind of put them in here. One is by Ray McNeice called "Grandfather's Breath," which I love, and he performs it way better than I will. But I'll read it because it really hits me right in the gut. Grandfather's Breath. He's from Cleveland, by the way. You work. You work. Buddy, you work. Word of immigrant, get ahead, grind, I hear huffing through me. Grandfather's breath, when he'd come in from Saturdays, keep busy chores, fending up a calloused hand to stop me from helping him. Haggard cheeks puffing out like T-shirts hung between tenements, doubled over under 35 years, a machine repairman at the ball-bearing factory, ball bearings making everything run smoother, especially torpedoes. He busted butt for the war effort, the profiteers for overtime pay, down payment on a little box of his own, himself a refugee from European economy washed ashore after the war to end all wars, cheap labor for the winners. I hear his youth plodding through the hay fields and the train that wheezed and lumbered to the boat where he heave-hoed consumptive sister, one, two, overboard. I hear him scuffling along factory smoke-choked streets of Cleveland, coughing out chunks of broken English just to put it into Saturday morning, Balinka. How he grunted off a week's worth of grit, hurling wooden balls down the pressed dirt court, sweaty wisp of gray hair wagging from his forehead. This is how the world turns. You work hard. You practice. And I hear his claim as we climb the steps of Municipal Stadium, higher into the cheap seats, slapping the flat of his hand against a girder. I built this, buddy. I built this. Mostly I hear how he'd catch what was left of his breath after those Saturday chores, pouring out that one long cold beer that Grandma allowed, holding it aloft, bubbles golden as hayfields, before savoring it and downing it, taking up the last drop of his day off, cleaning the cage, letting Snowball, the little canary they used to test in the coal mines for poison air, flap clumsily free around the living room, crapping on the plastic-covered Davenport and easy chair they only sat in twice a year. And I'm breathing, Grandfather, the day you took me down the basement to the cool floor to find out what was wrong. Come on, Snowball, fly! The bird splayed out on the same linoleum where they found you, where Grandma mopped for weeks after pointing with her arthritic finger. See there? That's where he fall. That's where he bump his head. See the specks of blood? She can't work out. And now I sing one fine morning when my work is done. I'm going to fly away. I'm going to fly away home. Come on, the Snowball. Fly. Fly. So this is one of my own poems that is in this collection. It's called Making It Right. And like the last one, to me, it captures aspects of working class life. And I kick it off with a quote from another working class poet and friend of mine from Detroit, Philip Levine. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is. Although you may not do it, forget you. I bring no poetry today from the oil and grease soul of my Detroit. The history I am is only and nothing more than the son of an auto worker. Just another Detroit man, beaten down by the tortured years of depression, world wars, and the awful angst of unemployment. This is my story where balance weighing heavier on the side of heartache and less on the side of the sacred and glorious. This is my story of what no work is and what it can do to the working class in the darkness of our desperation. I wish now I did have some kind of little poem to say out loud right here to make you all understand what it is inside the blackened heart and under the whittled bones of the people who have been left behind in the ashes of the plant. I guess I could read you a poem about how labor takes a boy and makes him a worker before he is allowed to become a man. How the factory humiliates and intimidates all people with endless assembly and useless work. How the line takes 1 ounce of every soul lived for every minute it is sped up to completion. How Henry Ford's great innovation doomed generations to continuous monotony in the name of making a living. But I'm afraid that I can only bring the small news of what becomes of people who work hard with greasy hands, about people who learn that their reality is having their names spelled out in factory smoke long before they were born, a birthright for workers to endure through the long loneliness of industry and unemployment lines, where we wait and wait for our bread and roses to fall from the sky like beads of perspiration upon our graves. We dream that maybe prosperity is really just around the corner. So we get up every morning with hope, and we return each night to the broken houses of our lives, seldom realizing that it is our labor that keeps this whole world together. I guess in the end, we do not know what work is, but still we continue to do it over and over and over, making it right.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet M.L. Liebler. He's reading from his new anthology entitled Working Words, Punching the Clock and Kicking Out the Jams. You talked about this anthology as an homage to the working class and to the life of the working class. I imagine when you put this together that it was hard to decide who would go in this because, you know, it's the history of everybody.
Well, it kind of was. I mean, you know, due to the logistics of it and the nature of publishing and funding and all that kind of stuff, in a way it wasn't as hard as it might seem. I mean, I feel very fortunate that, one, all the people in the collection – from Bob Dylan to I could say Emily Dickinson, but she's public domain, to Michael Moore and everybody else in here, they were willing to be part of it because of the importance of the subject, and what that translates into in the business world is gratis. So in that way, I went to people that I really often taught their work in my labor studies classes at Wayne State, and which I would normally Xerox a lot of these pieces. So I went to those people as I knew them, and everybody signed on, and it became like a tidal wave, if you will. You know, once people started signing on, everybody did. So everybody in it joined it, whether it was estates in some cases like Woody Guthrie's or Dorothy Day's or whatever, signed on to be part of it for the right reason, which is really – kind of amazing and important to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Well, I know you're citing some big names in popular culture and in labor history. But also, there are a number of poets and writers in the book who are contemporaries right now, who are living right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a number of people in it. Some are you know, I think of one who was a finalist for the National Book Award, Bonnie Jo Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this book was kind of collected and put together, and she had a piece that I'd been using in my classes from the Bottom Dog Press collection, Larry Smith's collections out of Huron, Ohio. And so I wanted that in there. And, of course, subsequent to that and other things, she becomes a National Book Award finalist. And mm-hmm. she was part of a series I edited at Wayne State, Made in Michigan series as well. But so there's some stories like that where people were, you know, just regional people who over the time that it took to put the book together and publish it have gone on to, you know, bigger acclaim and so forth.
Right. Could you read some more?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. Well, think about it.
Well, let's see. There's 500 and, 60 pages here. Well, here's one, you know, since we're on the radio, by Andrei Codrescu. He's a friend of mine. And it's a short poem called Working for Profit. I grow old, not tall, smiling at the unserviceable idea of self, which is not myself, to which myself serves as a tool for undoing the locks on the mysterious language capsules whose timers are ticking in the drawers of the state, a self of enclosure, a fossil dreaming of becoming the animal it once was by employing me to create every detail of its destroyed world, and smiling because I am not recreating, I am playing in the mud with a new body.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a poem that is a little more maybe abstract, but still captures at its very essence the working class experience. And that's something I have been saying to folks who are interested in this book, is it's not a book just about poems about work. It's, you know, there's everything going on in this book that mm-hmm. deals with living the life that, you know, essentially from what I'm understanding from the newspapers, 98% of us live.
Yeah, right.
So this is how the other 98% live, is represented. And some of it is not pretty, and some of it isn't nice, And, you know, there's all aspects to it. But other parts are biting commentary, political. Others are very humorous, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm. I know you have some poems by Maggie Anderson, Jim Daniels, you know, a lot of poets from this region.
Well, you know, that's true. But here's one little twist, and I'm always into changing things up.
Mm-hmm.
I love the change-up pitch. Like Jim Daniels is in the book, but I used a story of his.
Mm-hmm.
He's known as a poet. Mm-hmm. He has written, you know, a few books of stories. But I used his story because his story that there was actually a film made, I believe, down
right
here.
No Pets.
No Pets, yeah, in the name of his first book of stories. It's such a great piece to use in a classroom, and it's interesting, engaging, you know, and for my purposes, it's sort of set in Detroit, although I think it's actually filmed in Pittsburgh. But
right. I know you have a lot of women in that book. Can you read some poems by women?
Let me see. Very happy to do this because this is one of my favorite poets, actually. We just did some work not too long ago in Italy, growing up Italian. And Maria Mazziotti Gillen, for those who don't know, is one of the best poets in America and one of the greatest working class writers ever. And I love her stuff. So this is Growing Up Italian. When I was a little girl, I thought everyone was Italian, and that was good. We visited our aunts and uncles, and they visited us. The Italian language smooth and sweet in my mouth. In kindergarten, English words fell on me, thick and sharp as hail. I grew silent. The Italian word balanced on the edge of my tongue, and the English word lost during the first moment of every question. It did not take me long to learn that olive-skinned people were greasy and dirty. Poor children were even dirtier. To be olive-skinned and poor was to be dirtiest of all. Almost every day, Mr. Landgraf called Joey a spaghetti bender. I knew that was bad. I tried to hide by folding my hands neatly on my desk and being a good girl. Judy, one of the girls in my class, had honey blonde hair and blue eyes. All the boys liked her. Her parents and grandparents were born in America. They owned a local tavern. When Judy's mother went downtown, she brought back coloring books and candy. When my mother went downtown, she brought back one small brown bag with a towel or a sheet in it. The first day I wore my sister's hand-me-down coat, Isabel said, "That coat looks familiar. Don't I recognize that coat?" I looked at the ground. When the other children brought presents for the teachers at Christmas, embroidered silk handkerchiefs and Evening in Paris perfume, I brought dishcloths made into a doll. I read all the magazines that told me why blondes have more fun, described girls whose favorite color was blue. I hoped for a miracle that would turn my dark skin light and that would make me pale and blonde and beautiful. So I looked for a man with blonde hair and blue eyes who would blend right in and who'd give me blonde, blue-eyed children who would blend right in and a name that could blend right in, and I would be melted down to a shape and color that would blend right in till one day, I guess I was 40 by then, I woke up cursing all those who taught me to hate my dark foreign self. And I said, here I am with my olive-toned skin and my Italian parents and my old poverty real as a scar on my forehead and all the toys we couldn't buy and all the words I didn't say, all the downcast eyes and folded hands and remarks I didn't make rise up in me and explode onto paper like firecrackers, like meteors. And I celebrate my Italian-American self, rooted in this, my country, where all those black, brown, yellow, olive-skinned people soon will raise their voices and sing this new anthem. Here I am, and I'm strong, and my skin is warm in the sun, and my dark hair shines, and today I take back my name and wave it in their faces like a bright red flag.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet M.L. Liebler, reading from his new anthology, Working Words, Punching the Clock, and Kicking Out the Jams, published by Coffee House Press. Wow, what a great poem.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And that also, you know, captures sort of the essence of parts of this book as well.
Yeah.
And then that's just, you know, from the poetry perspective.
Right. Yeah. Maria Gillen is amazing. If those of you listening don't know her work, please look it up.
Check her out. You know, yeah. she is one of the – and, you know, I've never seen her give a reading – where immediately her books don't sell out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just incredible. Don't we all wish, you know, for that?
Yeah.
And she relates to everybody.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Who else do you want to read from there? Do you want to read more of yours or what are you thinking?
You know, there's so many different kinds of things in here. You know, one is one of my favorites. Well, everybody is, but one of my favorite writers in here is – and one of the first persons I thought of and a good friend to have is Antler. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, has Antler ever been to Pittsburgh maybe?
Not that
maybe
I know
not.
Of. I've definitely heard of him.
Yeah, well, Antler is a really interesting guy and he looks like Walt Whitman. In fact, I think Ginsberg at one time hailed him as the Walt Whitman to come.
Okay.
And when he was one of the young poets Ginsberg endorsed. There were about three or four back in the late 60s. And Antler was one, but he wrote this long poem. I'm not going to read the whole poem, just mm-hmm. a little snippet. But he wrote a long poem that City Lights put out called Factory.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew whenever a book like this came together, it would have Antler in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, since his name's Antler and it's alphabetical for people to find things easily, it's towards the front.
Okay.
But I'm just going to read a little bit. Antler is just a great, great reader and writer. It's Factory, Part 1. And the Factory's in several parts, almost like Song of Myself. The machines waited for me to be born and grow young, for the totem poles of my personality to be carved and the slowly pyramid of days to rise around me, to be robbed and forgotten. They waited where I would come to be, a point on earth, the green machines of the factory, the noise of miraculous machines of the factory, waited for me to laugh so many times, to fall asleep and rise awake so many times, to see a child, all the people I did not want to be, and for suicide to long for me as the years ran into the mirror, disguising itself as I grew old in the eyes that grew old, as multitudes worked on machines, I would work on, worked, ceased to exist, and died. For me, they waited patiently, the machines, all the time in the world as requiems waited for my ears. They waited as naked magazines waited for my eyes. They waited as I waited for soft machines like my time zones, away from me, unknown to be face, flesh, all the ways of saying goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just a snippet of the first part of Antler's poem.
Yeah, you can hear that big voice, that far-ranging talk.
Yeah, he's and the way he looks at things. You know, he worked in this factory and wrote this poem, but he also spends part of his time in you know, like living in the woods, kind of Whitman-esque, and or Edward Muir, you know, is a big hero of his, the
mm-hmm.
naturalist.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
So what would you tell the listeners in terms of what they need to get from this book? Like,
well, you know, one of the things I say in the introduction, and it's something I was just speaking with the Catholic Worker Movement in New York. One of the ideas behind the book is to have worker roundtables, which is something Peter Morn was a philosophy of his, the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement with Dorothy Day. And they still have that at the New York House of Hospitality. And I'm going to at some point host a roundtable using this book kind of for the purpose it was invented, which is to sit with other people, read a couple of pieces, whether they be poems or stories or excerpts of the nonfiction, and then have a discussion about what it all means to the workers and to each person and wherever they're coming from. So it's kind of – it's a twofold thing. It's one meant for – to provoke discussion amongst workers and the working class, whether that be in community centers or in, you know, union halls, libraries. But also it's a kind of literature that isn't simple, but in a general sense, you don't need a PhD to feel it.
Mm-hmm.
It speaks to that aspect of us as human beings that just makes sense.
Right.
And you don't have to be from the working class to pick up this book. I mean, if you by reading it, you'll learn about an America in many cases that we used to know, that in Detroit, perhaps Pittsburgh too, doesn't really exist anymore because of the factories have closed up and gone away. And so in one way, it becomes kind of archival.
Right.
It's history.
It's great. It's a great book. And also, it seems like really – perfect book for use in the classroom, for scholars to use and have a panel and to read on the street corner. I mean, it's a range. You can do a lot of things with this book.
Yeah, exactly. And it's reasonably priced, and you don't have to take out a college loan to get it. which is really interesting to me, because a book of this size for such a small price. I was telling somebody, my own book, my recent book is, almost as much as this book,
from
a university press.
Right.
So Coffee House has really done a service for the literary arts and the working class by making this available, I think.
Yeah, I agree. We have time for one more poem.
Okay. Well, let me end with another favorite, sort of in the region. It's probably a person who is pretty well known, I think a Pitt poet too.
Yeah.
Maggie Anderson. Love Maggie Anderson from Kent State. Spitting in the Leaves. In Spanish Burg, there are boys in tight jeans, mud on their cowboy boots, and they wear huge hats with feathers, skunk feathers, they tell me. They do not want to be in school, but are. Some teachers cared enough to hold them, unlike their thin, disheveled cousins. The boys are Matoka's Main Street in October, who loll against the parking meters and spit into the leaves. Because of them, someone will think we need a war, will think that the best solution would be for them to take their hats and feathers, their good country manners, and drag them off somewhere, to Vietnam, to El Salvador. And they'll go. They'll go from West Virginia, from hills and back roads that twist like politics through trees, and they'll fight not because they know what they're fighting for, but because they know how to fight. What they know is feathers, their strong, skinny arms, their spitting in leaves.
Great poem. Great poem. I want to thank you personally for putting this book together.
Thank you.
It's a great tribute. You've been listening to Elmel Liebler talk about his new anthology, Working Words, Punching the Clock and Kicking Out the Jams. Thank you so much for being here, Elmel.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's always great to come to Pittsburgh.
Ours too. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts and entertainment newsweekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Wednesday night at 7:30 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.